The ingenuity of the criminal class has rarely been criticised for lacking in imagination. One of the finer examples of this concept was put on full display in America on the eve of the presidential election in 1876, when a group of shady crooks who took the American dream of making money a little too literally decided they needed to bust one of their own from prison. The affair that unfurled led to one of the strangest stories in criminal history, featuring a small bag of relatively useless tools, an undercover Secret Service informant, and the remains of a dead president. This is Dark Histories, where the facts are worse than fiction. Hello and welcome to Dark Histories, Season 8, Episode 7. I'm Ben, your host. Today it's Easter Sunday. Happy Easter, everybody. I hope you're enjoying the, well, if you're in the, at least if you're in the southeast of England, probably roughly near me, I hope you enjoyed the sun today. It was a beautiful spring day, beautiful Easter's day, really. So that was great. Anyway, enough about the weather. That's a little bit too British, isn't it? I thought this week we would do something a little bit sort of quirkier, go for one of those kind of sort of slightly humorous, quirky historical tales. Because, you know, it's spring and I felt like we haven't really had too much of one of them this season. And, you know, I just feel like they help to counterbalance some of the sort of darker elements of the podcast. So, yeah, this week's episode, it's a sort of heist, I guess. A strange heist, but it's a heist, which again, we don't do too many of those on Dark History, so I think it's something quite fun. Anyway, let's get on with it. This week's episode is called Counterfeiting, Undercover Agents, and the Abduction of Abraham Lincoln. Prior to the Civil War in America, money, nowadays taken for granted as a universal unit, came in a variety of fairly chaotic forms. Towards the end of the 18th century, the United States Mint had been manufacturing a fairly large quantity of gold and silver coins, but outside of this, there had been little efforts to standardise currency across the country. European money that hadn't flowed back to its origin country, especially Spanish, Dutch, German and Portuguese coins, had been commonly in use for years, with British coins being relatively scarce. Outside of hard currency, a selection of commodities had often formed the basis for payments since the earliest settler days, when bartering was king, including beaver pelts, tobacco, and wampum, a form of shell bead manufactured by Native Americans in the East. This overly complicated and unwieldy system of exchange was only compounded by the fact that the actual value of a single unit of currency varied from state to state, meaning a sixth of a dollar in South Carolina was worth significantly less than the same in Georgia. On top of all this, from the moment any form of currency existed in North America, it was plagued by the compulsion of criminals to get rich from the counterfeit. For centuries, people have been clipping and shaving coins across the globe, scraping off a tiny amount of metal from individual coins and saving the material until they eventually had enough to form bullion. In America, laws were eventually drawn up in the late 17th century against the clipping of coins, and so in response, as shaving and clipping coins became too difficult, the next natural step was for the criminals to simply make their own. It was quickly discovered that the job of the early counterfeiter was made all the easier by the huge variety of coins that were in circulation, making distinguishing a particular forgery incredibly difficult. This already difficult landscape was further helped along by laws that were at times lackadaisical and at others absolutely nonsensical, with states choosing to criminalise the forging of only a certain denomination or currency. Some states made counterfeiting a certain coin punishable by death, whilst at the same time turning a completely blind eye to others. When bills of credit were introduced in Massachusetts in 1690, Britain, who saw the creation of a standardised currency as a dangerous sign of independence and a threat to their colonial rule, regulated and eventually restricted its usage hard for almost 100 years, until they were forced to amend the parliamentary acts that they had put in place to ease up on restrictions and allow states to issue paper money once more. When the American War of Independence broke out a few years later, in 1775, a new form of paper money was issued throughout the states, known as Continental Currency, which Congress hoped would help to fund the war. The new bills failed somewhat quickly. Local distrust of the currency helped along in no small part by the British, who flooded the market, utilising newspaper vendors stationed throughout New York, Boston, and Philadelphia, with tens of thousands of counterfeit dollars, in order to intentionally depreciate its value and lead to its rapid decline. This early economic warfare was so successful that within 6 years, the bills had grown absolutely worthless and were eventually discontinued entirely following a failed reform. The economic takedown of the American economy by the British became a display of one of the earliest forms of mass counterfeiting in America. And in response, Congress founded the first central financial institution chartered by the United States, the Bank of North America, in 1782, who minted their own coins a year later and adopted the United States dollar as the principal form of currency across the country. Over the following decades, individual banks began printing their own notes as paper money grew in popularity, leading to a plethora of over 1,000 different designs and styles. This presented a huge problem, however, as paper notes were infinitely easier to manufacture than counterfeit coins, and taking their cues from the British, criminality thrived as a practical golden age in forgery and counterfeiting exploded. Just like before in early America, with the vast variety of coins, the numerous designs from the thousands of different banks only sought to help the criminals, who found passing off an unfamiliar note painfully simple. Soon, counterfeiting became an industrial business, as printers went to town running off reams of fake currency, which they then sold off in bulk to dealers, who in turn sold it to the passers, who ironically paid the most for each bill and at the same time bore the brunt of the risk by taking the money out into the real world in order to spend or trade, entering the fake bills into general circulation. United States marshals did their best to rein in the counterfeiters, but with unhelpful laws that offered up a degree of protection to the printers due to their startling inefficiency, the problem ran rampant. When civil war broke out in 1861, the fighting once again signalled the advancement and evolution of the American financial system, as paper money was centrally printed once more in order to create a unified currency and to help finance the fighting. Central notes were issued to phase out the state's individual bills, and with their issuance, despite efforts to complicate the manufacture using complicated processes, including a committee of signees who would sign each note, printers became specialists in copying the distinctive paper currency. Having a single design actually made it easier to forge in many respects, or at least easier to distribute, as one good plate could now print notes that were usable nationwide, and they lacked the inherent suspicion of an unfamiliar note. As time went on, and amateurs were slowly rooted out by the marshals, experts flourished, and the forgeries only increased in quality. Gone were the old days, where notes were so crude that they frequently contained glaring typos, and a dawn came of skilled printers and engravers, who were cherished by the underworld of organised crime, who were able to print notes so convincing that even experts at the Treasury had trouble declaring a note counterfeit. By the end of the Civil War, it was estimated that somewhere over a third and all the way to 50% of the currency in circulation was counterfeit. This forced the hands of the officials, fearing the economy of being in danger of collapsing completely under the weight of the worthless bills. Abraham Lincoln, the then President of the United States, tasked the Secretary of the Treasury, Hugh McCulloch, with establishing a commission to figure out a way to halt the problem posed by the rampant counterfeiting. This eventually led to the formation of the United States Secret Service, who would operate as a bureau of the Treasury Department. Unfortunately, Lincoln would not see its establishment himself, as he was assassinated shortly after delegating the task to McCulloch. Although some efforts had been made to round up the counterfeiters in the years leading up to 1865, which had seen the arrest of some 30 or so prominent printers and pushers, this new force, masterminded by McCulloch, would work permanently to crush the criminal gangs responsible for creating the counterfeits, with the hope that, by focusing at the heart of the problem, the whole ring could be stamped out and the economy saved. William P. Wood was sworn in as the head of the service, and around 30 men were employed. Special badges were cast and commissions were actioned. The service was headquartered in Washington, with 11 satellite offices in cities across North America. Within a year, over 200 arrests had been made. Frequently, counterfeiters were used against one another, and it was soon discovered that capturing just one who could be coerced into becoming an informant could lead to the arrest of dozens more. The methods employed by the Secret Service were often revolutionary and just as often deeply unethical, but no one could argue against their effectiveness. Going undercover would frequently see agents engage in unlawful behaviour, and when that became too risky, ropers, individuals familiar with the underworld, were unofficially employed on an agreed rate to do the dirty work for them. Very quickly, a vast network of intelligence sprang up around the individual agents, as the cloak and dagger world of surveillance became the primary method of disrupting entire criminal gangs. Which is exactly what was happening on the evening of the 20th of October, 1875, as Captain Patrick Tyrrell from the Chicago branch of the Secret Service sat outside a house in Fulton, Illinois, watching men come and go for several days. Born in Cincinnati, Ohio, in 1834, Benjamin F. Boyd was the second in an emerging line of skilled engravers. His father had made a good trade as an engraver, and he'd taught Benjamin the basics after he'd shown some interest and talent at a young age. As he grew older, Boyd's father arranged a year-long apprenticeship for him under one of Ohio's most well-known and skilled engravers named James Edward Smith. Boyd's talents blossomed under the tutelage, and before long, he began fostering his own fledgling reputation. Cincinnati was home to another skilled engraver too, one somewhat less straight, and hearing all about the upcoming talent, he took it upon himself to introduce a different kind of engraving to the young Benjamin. Nat Kinsey had started out engraving landscapes in Delaware before turning his hand to counterfeiting greenbacks, an area of expertise that he more or less mastered with the release of his $100 bill that was so successful it remained in circulation, completely undetected, for several years. Kinsey's unorthodox and highly illegal line of work seemingly sparked something within Boyd, who saw his path taking a fairly wide diversion from his father's. By the age of 21, Boyd was carving out plates of copper and steel in efforts to emulate currency under the watchful eye of Kinsey almost full time. When the federal government made the decision in 1862 to distribute a unified national currency, Boyd was perfectly poised to capitalize. In partnership with fellow engraver Pete McCartney, the two set up a printing house in Illinois, and they did their best to strike it rich. Unfortunately, for the ambitious entrepreneurs, the authorities were not so keen to see them make their fortune, flooding the market with fake currency, and a sweep of their establishment 3 years later in 1865 saw the pair arrested, with McCartney winding up in prison. Boyd escaped the lockup by trading a plate for a counterfeit $50 bill, securing the release of both himself and his soon-to-be wife, Almiranda Eichmann, who was herself a skilled engraver. Following the Illinois sting, Boyd shrugged off the loss and married Almiranda, and the pair made a steady living, bouncing from state to state, avoiding the law and printing dodgy money. Over the years, his talents only continued to grow with experience, and the decade saw one of his finest creations, the counterfeit of a $5 bill first issued by Traders National Bank of Chicago, that was so good that not even the original printers were said to have been able to tell a legitimate note from a forgery. Eventually, after several years of popular use, the whole run of notes had to be recalled in a somewhat sledgehammer approach to solving the problem that was otherwise impossible to control. By October of 1874, the Boyd's luck for steering clear of the authorities was running dangerously low. 3 years earlier, Boyd had entered into something of a partnership with another talented counterfeiter named Nelson Driggs, with the two working remotely. Driggs set up in Centralia, Illinois, whilst Boyd and Almiranda worked from a small two-story house at the other end of the state in the small town of Fulton. Both men were part of a counterfeiting ring being run by an Irish-born American known as James Big Jim Keneally, who, with the talents of Boyd and Driggs under his umbrella, had big plans in the counterfeiting industry. Sadly, they were due to be stifled by Elmer Washburn, the then chief of the Secret Service, who had spent several years reforming the service into a shadowy network that had put a serious dent into the counterfeit trade, utilising surveillance, informants and, crucially, the knowledge of the counterfeiters' networks themselves. Captain Patrick D. Tyrrell had been trailing Boyd using all three techniques for over 8 months, until finally, on the night of the 20th October, the Secret Service were ready to carry out a simultaneous sting on both Driggs and Boyd. Tyrrell had been born in Ireland in 1832, and he'd moved to the States with his family at the age of just 9 years old. By the age of 20, he'd gotten married and had his first child, before moving to Chicago and joining the police. He quickly rose through the ranks, moving to a detective role, before being promoted into the Secret Service, where he was employed as a captain. Tyrrell was, in many respects, the embodiment of the American dream. He'd crossed the Atlantic and, within a decade, settled down to a comfortable home life amongst the respectable middle classes. For all his integrity as an officer of the law, however, he didn't entirely stick to clean living. And whilst he sat outside the home of Benjamin F. Boyd, waiting for the time to strike, he left his wife at home, along with his daughter-in-law, who they had taken in after the death of her husband and Tyrrell's son. This arrangement was all well and good, had Tyrrell and his recently widowed daughter-in-law not been having an affair. Tyrrell sat outside the Boyds, along with service operative John MacDonald and the assistant chief of the Secret Service, James B. Brooks. All three had been surveilling the Boyds' rented home on 13th Avenue, and it was almost 4 a.m. when Tyrrell decided it was time to approach the front door and wake up Benjamin and now Miranda. Unfortunately, the pair were already awake, and as he stepped over the fence to the house, a man riding by in a carriage shouted loudly in what Tyrrell presumed to be a prearranged signal, as soon as the voice echoed through the streets, the front door burst open and Nat Kinsey fled for the road. Having no warrant for Kinsey's arrest, Tyrrell let the engraver be, and with a renewed sense of urgency, he signalled to Brooks to remain in the yard whilst he sprinted round to the back of the house and, slamming through the back door, found himself face to face with Almiranda Boyd. Almiranda lunged forwards, grabbing Tyrrell, attempting to drag him back, whilst Tyrrell barged past her and leapt up the stairs. At the top, he found Benjamin Boyd, who, confused at the whole situation, asked Tyrrell who he was. Tyrrell gave his name, and with a deflated sigh of resignation, Boyd allowed himself to be handcuffed and given into the care of Brooks. Whilst Boyd was led out from the house, Tyrrell began turning the place over. It was a damning haul for Boyd and an absolute goldmine for the officials. In one of the bedrooms, Tyrrell found a workbench covered in engraving tools, along with an unfinished plate for $20 bills. That morning, the officers dug up over $7,800 in genuine currency, stashed away in a box, along with the finished plates for making $100 bills. Meanwhile, in Centralia, Driggs was suffering the same fate. The officers in charge uncovered 15 plates for counterfeit cash, along with over $117,000 in phony bills. Boyd did his best to get himself and Miranda off the hook again, promising to bargain everything he knew about counterfeiting. But it was all for nothing. Benjamin and Almiranda were tossed up in front of a judge before being jailed to await trial. Their bail set at an eye-watering $30,000 for Benjamin and $15,000 for Almiranda. Their trial was as cut and dry as could be. Almiranda was eventually acquitted on account that the judge agreed with her defence that she was simply carrying out the orders of her husband, as any dutiful wife should. Boyd, who had finally managed to strike a deal with the Secret Service for information, was jailed for 10 years on a reduced sentence. The sting had been a strong operation for the Secret Service, and soon after, Tyrrell found himself promoted to chief of the Chicago Department. Meanwhile, on the other side of the law, the jailing of Driggs and Boyd had been a huge knock to Big Jim Keneally's counterfeiting operation. Two of his best engravers had been taken out in a single day, and replacing an engraver as skilled as Boyd was no simple task, if it was possible at all. Every dealer and pusher in the Midwest suffered from their jailing. Keneally would have to come up with some plan if he was to continue operating as before. And so, that's exactly what he did. Abraham Lincoln had been elected as the 16th President of the United States, the first ever leader of the Republican Party, on November 6, 1860. The election had been a divisive affair, and the result had led to the formation of the Confederacy after a handful of southern states split from the Union and declared themselves a sovereign nation, paving the way for the American Civil War that saw fighting break out a month after Lincoln took office. Lincoln served as president for 4 years before he was assassinated by a Confederate spy named John Wilkes Booth, who shot the president in the back of the head whilst he was watching a play at Ford's Theatre in Washington, D.C. on the evening of April 14, 1865. Following his death, the body of Lincoln was escorted by his eldest son, Robert Todd Lincoln, via train to Springfield, Illinois, where Lincoln had lived and practiced law prior to his bid for the presidency. Meanwhile, a group of Illinois citizens formed the National Lincoln Monument Association and set about raising the $240,000 needed to build a grand tomb that would be situated in the quiet, rural Oak Ridge Cemetery. Finally completed in 1874, the tomb was built from bold white granite. Stairs flanked either side of the circular entrance, leading to a square parapet, and in the centre, an obelisk stood 117 feet tall, piercing the skyline across the cemetery. Inside the tomb, Lincoln's remains were interred inside a lead-lined red cedar coffin, which was then placed within a solid marble sarcophagus and sealed away behind an iron door. The security was as tight as any tomb. A single custodian, John Carroll Power, oversaw a collection of Lincoln-related relics and gave guided tours of the place, but otherwise the site was more or less unmanned. After all, why would it be any other way? Who in their right mind would want to steal the remains of a dead president? And for what reason? Back in Chicago, Keneally had been stewing over a way to break Benjamin Boyd out of prison, and he finally thought he had come up with a plan. He contacted the head of a small counterfeiting ring from Logan County, Illinois, who were headed up by the newspaper editor Thomas J. Sharp. Sharp ran what was affectionately described as a sprightly little daily, but on the side, he oversaw a ring of pushers and dealers who spent a fair amount of time quietly disseminating counterfeit currency purchased from Keneally. Since the arrest of Boyd, everyone was suffering, and so Keneally had charged Sharp with carrying out his plan, primarily because he knew he would accept the opportunity to get the gravy train back on track. Keneally told Sharp to gather four or five of the Logan County gang's members and travel to Springfield to open a saloon. Sharp did as he was told and gathered up five other men: Robert Splain, an experienced saloon owner, James L. Fox, a farmer, and his son, James Jr., who had worked as a barman in Splain's saloon. He also enlisted the help of Benjamin F. Sheridan and Vine G. Williams, who was little more than a drunk bum. Of course, opening the saloon was not going to solve all the counterfeiters' problems. The bar was little more than a front. The real plan, that they would plan thoroughly in the back room of the Springfield saloon, was to break into the Lincoln tomb, steal the remains of the dead president, and ransom them for a pretty penny, throwing the release of Benjamin Boyd into the bargain for good measure. It was a surefire hit. Sharp and his boys were to carry the body 60 miles northwest to the Sangamon River, where they would sink it and slink off into the night. Keneally would then stumble across the remains whilst out fishing, and since he would have a bulletproof alibi for the night of the robbery, he would get away with everything scot-free. In March of 1876, the Logan County gang made their way to Springfield, rented a store on Jefferson Street, and opened their saloon, flawlessly executing step one of the grand plan. Over the following weeks, the five men spent their time running a badly stocked bar, drinking and scheming. They each visited the Lincoln Monument and partook in a guided tour, where they discovered that inside the tomb, the burial chamber was sealed by two doors. The first, a glass pane door, was no problem at all, but the second was an iron door with steel rods and locked up by a heavy padlock. It was a little more challenging, but still, for the most part, it was nothing a few tools couldn't take care of, and confidence ran high within the group, especially as they had discovered that there was no night guard to speak of. Hauling the remains off to the Sangamon River could cause trouble, however, and so they altered this part of the plan, instead choosing to cart it off on a stolen wagon and bury it in a gravel bar beneath a bridge 2 miles out of town. That year's July the 4th celebrations promised to be a busy few days, given that it was the centennial year, and so they reasoned that the night of July the 3rd would offer them a good amount of cover, as everyone would be out celebrating in town. Furthermore, with the patriotic feeling running so high, the ransom for the bones could be all the more grand. With everything solved and ready to go, the gang settled on getting drunk whilst they waited for the big night, which was, it would turn out, a fairly big mistake. Sharp, never having been one to shy away from attention, thought it not especially harmful to boast about the plan to a madam that had taken his fancy at a brothel one night. The story started out vague enough at first, but then, throwing caution to the wind, he blurted out that he and a few boys were planning to steal old Lincoln's bones on the 4th of July. In fact, he told her the entire plan from start to finish. It didn't take long, of course, for the madam to spread the news about, shocking as it was, but it just so happened that another acquaintance of the brothel happened to be the chief of police, Abner Wilkinson, who took something of a dim view of the news that his town was harbouring a gang of body-snatching, conspiring counterfeiters. Wilkinson called in the custodian of the monument, John Carroll Power, who had unknowingly shown the Logan County gang around, who in turn called in the chairman of the executive committee for the Monument Association, John T. Stewart. Stuart gathered Colonel John Williams and Jacob Brown, two of Lincoln's close confidants in life, and all the men gathered to hear the story directly from Wilkinson. Despite being given the exact date of the planned robbery, the men all agreed that the story was just too far-fetched to bother organising any extra security. It was all just too unbelievable. Fortunately for them, rumours of the raid reached all the way back to Keneally, who, angry that his team had spread the details of their plan throughout the town, just called the whole thing off. Under the cover of darkness, Sharp folded the saloon and all five men split from Springfield, skulking back off to their headquarters in Lincoln. Frustrated at the gang's incompetence, Keneally made his way to Chicago, where he sought out a new network and took his plan back to the drawing board. The Hub was a popular saloon and billiard hall situated in Chicago at 294 West Madison Street, run by a young Irish immigrant named Terence Mullen. It was a fairly rough establishment, nearly bare of furniture and decoration, save for a single bust of Abraham Lincoln that perched up behind the bar. After moving to Chicago, Keneally entered something of a silent partnership with Mullen, and whilst Mullen lived just around the corner and tended the bar daily, Keneally stayed well clear of any actual business work, only ever going there to drink and hang out in the back room. Unsurprisingly, the Hub was already well known to the Secret Service as something of a den for counterfeiters. Mullen had reportedly been involved in a string of thefts somewhere on the East Coast before he'd moved to Chicago, and everyone knew that he pushed forged cash and carried a gun. The regulars were none too clean either. Herbert Nelson was a legitimate and reasonably well-known and successful freight hauler by day, but on the side, he supplied dealers with counterfeit cash purchased from Keneally. Then there was Jack Hughes, one of the most well-known pushers in Chicago. A one-time frontier farmer who'd had enough of the labouring life, Hughes had turned his hand to pushing forged cash for years, first in Philadelphia and now in Chicago. He'd been arrested on charges of passing $5 bills, but had skipped bail and was now choosing to keep his head somewhat low, mainly by spending his days drinking at the Hub. Alarmingly, it was in these three men that Keneally began dreaming of his riches and an escape for Boyd once more. One evening, Keneally called Mullen and Nelson into the back room of the Hub and invited them in on his new plan. The new plan was actually much the same as the old plan, but this time, Keneally had a solid number in mind for the ransom. Lincoln's remains, he decided, were worth a cool $200,000 in ransom. With such a high figure being bandied about, both men were keen to be involved, though Nelson, concerned for his business reputation, was less keen to take an active role, and as such, he suggested bringing in a third man, singling out Jack Hughes on account of his history of pushing counterfeit bills, along with the convenient fact that his sister was engaged to Mullen. He was practically family after all. Keneally and Mullen agreed, and Hughes was brought in on the plan, for which he also readily agreed to be a part of. Bringing Hughes in on the act did pose one small problem in the form of the police, who were still chasing him after he'd recently skipped out on his bail. His luck folded only 10 days later, when the Hub was raided and Hughes was carted back to prison. Initially, his bail was set at $3,000, but he managed to have it reduced to $2,000, and a month later, he was back out on the streets. The small hiccup didn't seem to overly faze any of the other men, who welcomed Hughes back to the Hub and back in on their plan. Whilst Hughes had been spending his days locked up in his cell, Mullen and Nelson had been taking a liking to another regular in the Hub named Jim Morrissey. Morrissey had approached Mullen and inquired about pushing counterfeit. He'd recently served time and was looking for a new line of work. When Mullen inquired what he'd been locked up for, his eyes lit up when Morrissey responded that he'd been making a living as a body snatcher, selling corpses to the local medical school for $5 a turn. There was every chance that Morrissey had all the specialist skills that they needed for their master plan. When Hughes got back to the Hub in mid-September, the men decided to test Morrissey to make sure that he was legit. They had a plan, they told him, to rob the grave of a rich man, who they ingeniously called Mr. King, who supposedly lived up in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and were planning on holding his remains to ransom. They invited Morrissey in on the plan, suggesting that his experience would be a nice boon to their party. Morrissey wasn't so sure. Having just recently served time for stealing bodies, He was hoping to get out of the business, he said. He promised to check in with his attorney and get back to them. Unfortunately for the crew in the hub, Morrissey's attorney suggested that the job would be too much of a high risk for the potential reward, and Morrissey relayed the information to the men, politely declining their offer to join them on their little escapade. What Morrissey didn't know was that, of course, Mr. King was purely fictitious, and Hughes and Mullen only wanted to see if Morrissey could keep his mouth shut. Since no one was talking about the plan on the streets, it seemed like he could. When Morrissey turned up to drink a few days later, he was promptly invited to the back room, where the real plan was laid out to him. Rather than steal Mr. King's remains, they actually intended to rob the tomb of Abraham Lincoln, hiding his body in the sand hills of Indiana before gaining hundreds of thousands of dollars for ransom, as well as the release of Boyd. Unfortunately for Hughes, Mullen and Nelson, Jim Morrissey had a secret. Principally that his name wasn't Jim Morrissey at all, but rather he was called Lewis C. Sweggles and was working as a roper, unofficially on the payroll of Captain Patrick Tyrrell. One of the more controversial practices, ropers, so named for the way they roped in the criminals for the Secret Service, were never truly employed by the authorities in any official capacity. Paid by the day or by the snippets of information given, they were in effect undercover operatives and informants, perfect for the job because they were culled from the same underworld that they were now snooping on. In fact, Hughes's recent arrest in August had largely been down to Sweggles' information gathering, Hughes being the very reason that he'd spent so much time in the hub in the first place. After Hughes's arrest, he'd stayed on at the hub in order to gather more information on a counterfeiting gang. Hardly straight himself, Sweggles had been a prominent horse thief in his day, before he'd been arrested in Wisconsin. Now in Chicago, he was doing his best to live a straight life, and decided to use his knowledge and reputation as an ex-thief who had done time in order to gain legitimacy and trust with his underworld peers, who he then snitched on to Tyrrell. It may not have been entirely honest work, but it was a few steps up from stealing horses, and he was at least now working with the law rather than against it. When Sweggles learned of the gang's plan to rob Lincoln's remains, he returned to Tyrrell immediately. Unfortunately, Tyrrell was out of town. So instead, he visited his attorney, C.W. Dean, and explained the situation to him. Dean suggested that he try his best to keep a balanced neutrality until Tyrrell returned. Meanwhile, he took the information to Leonard Sweat, a Chicago-based defense lawyer and close personal friend of Lincoln's son, Robert Todd Lincoln. In truth, just like the men in Springfield, Sweat didn't put much stock in the story, finding the whole thing to be too preposterous to be true. But he thought he should pass the news along all the same, just in case. It seemed that Robert felt the same way, however, and so he wrote a letter to John Todd Stewart instead, the chairman for the National Lincoln Monument Association, suggesting that, with the plan afoot, he should perhaps consider some sort of safeguard in practice. Fortunately, for once, Stewart actually listened, and taking the advice, he decided to employ a pair of night watchmen, with each man given a pistol just in case the worst should happen. When Tyrrell returned in late October, Sweggles finally told him all about the plan. Tyrrell considered it for a moment and then gave Sweggles the nod, agreeing that going along with the plan as a member of the team in order to learn as much as he could would be a worthwhile endeavour. He instructed Sweggles to return to the hub and agreed to steal Lincoln's remains with Hughes and Mullen, and then the captain did something that fit with the Secret Service's slightly unorthodox method. Contacting the monument's custodian, John Carroll Power, he instructed him to stand down the newly instated night watchman. Instead, he wanted to allow the gang to have a good go at robbing the tomb so that he and his men would be able to catch them red-handed. When Sweggles returned to the hub, he confirmed with Hughes and Mullen that he wanted in on the plan. In order to explain his prolonged decision-making, he said he'd visited his attorney, who had confirmed that in Springfield, the maximum jail term for grave robbing would be 1 year with a small fine, and on the balance of things, $200,000 was a pretty healthy reward for such little risk. With Sweggle now on board, the gang took to planning in earnest, holding meetings regularly in the back room, with all the information discussed flowing straight back to Tyrrell as soon as Sweggles could get in touch with him. There was a small hitch when Sweggles was forced to admit that a marble sarcophagus may be a little bit out of his league, as he had been a pretty lowly body snatcher after all. Instead, He suggested that they draft in a specialist who had experience with explosives. Fortunately for the gang, Nelson thought he knew a man. Unfortunately for Sweggles, the man was Johnny Lamb, who knew Sweggles and thought him highly dubious, suspecting him of being a roper. In the end, everything worked out fine after Lamb refused the job anyway. Sweggles suggested his own man instead, a man that he called Billy Brown, who he said was a miner and stone man from his old life. In truth, Billy Brown was actually Bill Neely, a bricklayer with an eye for turning roper. Everyone agreed to seek his help. Neely had a brief interview with Tyrrell, and just like that, there were now two undercover Secret Service men gearing up for the job. Neely's interview with Hughes and Mullen was a little tougher, with some intense questioning about his abilities, but Bill played up his experience well, and then excused himself, saying that he'd have to spend a few days gathering the proper explosive powder and tools. Next, the gang had to figure out how they were going to fund the plan. Hughes came up with the idea of trading some of his sister's property against his $2,000 bail, in order to bargain the money back. Sweggles informed Tyrrell, who instructed the courts to deny Hughes's request, and when they rejected the deal, Hughes and Mullen settled to do the job on a shoestring instead, exactly as Tyrrell had hoped. Instead of employing a team of men with carts to do the job properly, they decided to simply shoulder the casket and carry it off. This was deeply underestimating the weight of the whole thing. In what would turn out to be a stroke of luck, everyone agreed that Bill and Sweggles should head to Canada after the job and lay low for a while, giving them the perfect excuse to get out of the way. Hughes's application to the courts had tied up a few weeks, but all of a sudden, things were moving incredibly fast. At the last minute, it was decided that the robbery would take place on election night, Tuesday, November the 7th, giving everyone just 2 days to get prepared. Meanwhile, back in Logan County, Splaine's Saloon was a hive of criminal activity as always. As it turned out, Keneally hadn't been the only one frustrated by their earlier failures. The Logan County gang members had been just as annoyed by their sudden dumping, and so they'd decided to regroup and carry on with their plan regardless. In what was a fantastic act of coincidence, they too had decided that election night would be the best time to carry out their own robbery on Lincoln's tomb. In what was either a fantastic act of mercy or a crime against comedy, the only thing that stopped them rolling up to the tomb and attempting to carry out a robbery, whilst a robbery was already underway, was a police raid on Splaine's Saloon the day before they planned to leave for Springfield, following one of the members turning state's evidence against them that landed the whole network in jail. Finally, the dawn of the big day arrived as the eve of the elections rolled around. That morning, Sweggles visited Tyrrell to relay the finalised plans for that evening. Tyrrell, in turn, ran Sweggles through his own plans. Sweggles was to remain undercover all the way through the robbery, assisting their break-in, and then, at the last moment, he was to signal to Tyrrell and his men, who would be perched in the shadows, watching on, ready to pounce. In one final audacious act, Tyrrell and his men would travel to Springfield on the exact same train as Sweggle and the gang, so that they could keep an eye on them all the way to the monument. Tyrrell was hoping to get some backup, but at such short notice, any officers from Washington would have never arrived on time. Instead, he contacted Alan Pinkerton of the Pinkerton Detective Agency and enlisted the aid of two men, Detective John C. McGinn and George May. At 9 p.m, Hughes, Mullen, Sweggles and Neely entered the train station, unaware that they were being watched all the way. One by one, they boarded the sleeper train, Mullen getting on first, carrying a small bag of tools, and behind him came Hughes, then Sweggles, and finally Neely. As the train pulled out of the station, Tyrrell and the detectives hopped aboard, whilst Neely, under the pretense that he was going to get some sleep in the rear of the train, hopped back off, as he had been advised to do so by Tyrrell, who didn't want him getting caught up in the robbery, as suspicion of his acting as a roper would naturally have fallen upon him once everyone else was arrested. It will be up to Sweggles to cover for his absence for as long as possible. And with that final move, the train was chuntering off into the night, bound for Springfield. When it arrived at 6 a.m. the following morning, the sun was yet to rise. Yet already crowds of people were gathering in the street, waiting for the polls to open for election day. When the Hub gang exited the train, their first port of call was to a nearby saloon, where they dropped off their tools and asked the barman to look after them until they came back to collect them later that evening. In what was yet another stroke of luck for Sweggles, Hughes and Mullen then ordered him to go and fetch Neely and take him to hire a cart and rig for removing the remains whilst they went and checked into the St. Charles House Hotel and caught up on some sleep. While Sweggles pretended to deal with Neely, who of course was still back in Chicago, he instead caught up with Tyrrell and the detectives, who had already checked into their own hotel. The detectives then went and visited the monument to get an idea of the layout, while Sweggles returned to the gang and told them that Neely had gone off to hire a team and would be back at around 6 p.m, conveniently taking care of his absence for the entire day. In the early afternoon, as the detectives were leaving the monument, Hughes and Sweggles made their own trip to case the place for themselves. The custodian, Power, who had just been given the gang's description by Tyrrell and instructed to act normal if any of the members came in that day, gave them the full tour, just as he would any other visitor. The monument sat on a flat piece of land with a steep hill sliding away to the north. Inside the circular frontage was the memorial chamber, and round the back of the building lay the entrance to the burial chamber, a second circular room mirroring the memorial hall, which was kept sealed by iron barred doors, securing the remains of the dead president, whose coffin lay inside a monolithic marble sarcophagus. Suddenly, the job seemed to entail a great deal more physical effort than they had first realised. When Hughes and Sweggles returned to the hotel that afternoon, they made some last-minute alterations to the plan, deciding to stash Lincoln's remains under a bridge by the river rather than try to cart them off to the sandhills. Whilst the Hub gang tinkered with their plans, Tyrrell and the detectives were waiting at their hotel, where they had been met by a surprise visitor. Elmer Washburn, the ex-chief of the Secret Service, had shown up to give Tyrrell a hand, on instructions of Robert Todd Lincoln, who at the last minute had decided to heed Tyrrell's warnings. Washburn came along with another detective and, bizarrely, a journalist for the Chicago Tribune, who had somehow managed to catch wind of the situation and had met Washburn on the train on the way to Springfield. He was, of course, planning to write up a scoop on the whole sting. Tyrrell, glad to have the extra manpower, filled Washburn in on the plan, introduced him to Sweggles, who had managed to slink away once more, and then, at 6 p.m, all the detectives made their way to the cemetery to meet with the custodian Power, who locked them into the memorial chamber, where they would lay in wait until the thieves arrived. Concerned that their boots would make too much noise on the stone floors, Tyrrell instructed everyone to take their boots off. With everyone in position, they sat in wait, turning out their lanterns and sitting in the dark of the locked tomb. Back in St. Charles's house, Mullen, Hughes and Sweggles were getting themselves ready to walk out to the cemetery. When Hughes inquired after Neely, Sweggles had told him that he had hired a car and would ride it out to meet them that evening as they were leaving the hotel. This plan startled Hughes and Mullen, who had been doing their best to remain as inconspicuous as possible. Concerned that a car might make them too noticeable, they ordered Sweggles to get in touch with Neely and turn him around, having him instead meet them out at the cemetery. This was a fantastic stroke of luck for the Ropers, and Sweggles gladly agreed to the new plan, knowing that it removed Neely from the picture entirely. Then, the three men retrieved their bag of tools and began the 2-mile walk to the monument. By the time they arrived at the cemetery, around 9 p.m, it stood in complete darkness, and the men lit the ground with a single bullseye lantern as they made their way quietly up the hill towards the rear of the tomb. With the monument in sight, Hughes and Mullen sent Sweggles ahead to shine the light through the door and check that the coast was clear. When he signalled back to them, they crept up behind him and, pulling out a handsaw, made their first efforts to cut through the thick padlock that hung from the barred door. It quickly became apparent that the saw was much too blunt to make any real headway, and so Sweggles made a loop of the monument on the pretense of keeping a lookout. When he swung by the front of the structure, he instead signalled to Tyrrell, who, creeping out of his hiding place, told Sweggles to bide his time and make sure that Hughes and Mullen were in the tomb before calling them out. By the time Sweggles had made his way back round to the rear door, Hughes had given up entirely on the saw and was instead attempting to file through the steel. When that failed, he pulled out a pair of pincers and finally brute forced the lock, which clattered to the ground, allowing the iron barred door to swing open on its hinges. Sweggles pulled out a cigar and went to light it, which was the pre-agreed signal that he'd arranged with Tyrrell. But before he could strike a match, Hughes was pushing him into the burial chamber and handing him the lantern, ordering him to stand on watch and shine the light on the sarcophagus so they could see what they were dealing with. Marlon took one look at the solid marble container and decided that continuing with brute force would be their best option. Concerned, Sweggle suggested that he try and pry it open first, using the excuse that they would have more time to get away if they could get to the remains without causing any noticeable damage. And his reasoning seemed to win over the smash-happy Mullen, who turned his axe and, instead of just bashing the lid, used the blade to try and lift the marble slab. With some effort, the stone slid from the body of the sarcophagus, exposing the second inner lid, which Mullen began working on prying up with a hammer and chisel. Eventually, the coffin was in sight. But so too was the stark reality that at over 500 pounds, the three men were woefully ill-prepared to leverage it out of its stone casing. Hughes joined in on the effort to lift the coffin, and as they strained away, it finally dawned on them that Neely was yet to arrive with the car. Hughes yelled at Sweggles to go and see if he was out in the cemetery somewhere, and the roper used it as his excuse to get outside, move out of sight of the two men who had inconveniently followed him up to the entrance, and then light up his cigar to signal Tyrrell. As soon as he was able, and the detectives saw the signal, they rushed out of their hiding places, leaving their boots behind and pulling their firearms as they moved. When they reached the burial chamber door, they saw no sight of Hughes and Mullen, and so Tyrrell ordered them to split up and search the grounds around the monument. Rushing up the stairs himself, he spied a figure in the distance, creeping away around one of the columns in the northwest corner. Opening fire, he rang out three shots in its direction, until with some horror, he spied a white handkerchief tied around his arm, a tactic that the detectives had all used in order to tell them apart from the grave robbers. He stopped firing just in time to hear the voice of one of the Pinkerton men yelling back at him. Slowly, all of the detectives reconvened and, composing themselves after what had been a fairly chaotic few moments, decided to split once more, with Washburn and McGinn staying to watch over the monument overnight, whilst Tyrrell and the others would head back to Chicago in the rough hope of heading off the gang before they made it back to their city safe houses. Meanwhile, the Chicago Tribune journalist made his way to the local newspaper office to pen his story for the day's paper, though it was far from the glamorous sting that Tyrrell had hoped. An attempt was made this evening to perpetrate one of the most infamous outrages which the mind of man can conceive of, that of stealing the bones and ashes of Abraham Lincoln. Unfortunately, the perpetrators escaped, leaving, however, the evidence of their crime behind them, and though the clues are next to nothing, if human ingenuity can track them, it will be done. The scheme concocted by these men is certainly unparalleled in the history of crime, and now that there is evidence of minds so debased, it is certain that measures will be taken to guard the monument and prevent future attempts. The police was so alarming, written with such sensationalism and so unthinkable for many, that a considerable majority thought that the whole thing was just a hoax, including the editors of the Chicago Times, who couldn't even seem to understand why anyone would have carried out the crime in the first place. Even those that did believe it began coming to some pretty strange conclusions, thinking it must have been some sort of dark conspiracy, which was a line of thought that remained for some time, even after the truth began to unfold. On the morning of the crime, however, everything was still shrouded in mystery, not least the names and identities of the perpetrators who had, for all intents and purposes, completely disappeared. Of course, the two men hadn't disappeared at all. When Hughes and Mullen had sent Sweggles off to fetch Healy, the two men had grown edgy waiting for his return, thinking it wise to slink off and wait in the shadows rather than hang around by the burial chamber door. They made their way to the bottom of the hill and kept watch for their return. Sweggles never did return, though, and when they saw the detectives instead, running round the monument, all guns blazing, with no boots, they made a dash for it, hopping the nearby fence and off along the road out of town. With the monument far behind them, they slowed to a walk but forged ahead, walking all through the night, until they reached a farmhouse the next morning. There, they stopped to ask directions to the railroad and then continued walking, following the tracks north out of Springfield. As they walked, Washburn and McGinn swept up the tools that they had abandoned at the entrance of the burial chamber, and after obtaining a warrant for Hughes and Mullen's arrest, made their way back to Chicago to meet with Tyrrell. Meanwhile, the coffin of Lincoln was secretly removed by the custodian, Power, and the empty sarcophagus was resealed. Lincoln's coffin was then taken beneath the burial chamber, where a winding labyrinth of foundations sat hidden 10 feet beneath the ground. The plan was to bury the coffin, but when the hole was dug, it filled with water, and so the coffin was left in the dark, out of sight and hidden away, until a new plan could be figured out. By the break of dawn on the 9th of November, Hughes and Mullen had made their way to the town of Chestnut, 30 miles north of Springfield. There, they boarded a train, handing the conductor their pistol in exchange for the security on their tickets, with Hughes promising to return to pay for them at a later date. They alighted at Melvin, around 60 miles from Springfield, and stopped over at an old acquaintance of Hughes for dinner, before they made the final stretch to Hughes' father's house, where they finally relaxed and spent the night. It had been some escape, but seemingly they'd made it safely. The next morning, Hughes borrowed enough money to return to Melvin Station and purchase his gun back, as well as to pay for a train ticket for Mullins back to Chicago. Hughes then made his way back to his father's, where he intended to lay low for a few days. Back in Chicago, Sweggles was cautiously poking his head into the hub to see if Mullen and Hughes had made it back. Fortunately, neither had seen him anywhere near the detectives that night, and so he hoped his cover had still not been blown. In the two men's absence, Keneally was tending to the bar alone, not at all happy with everything that he'd been reading in the papers. The next morning, on Friday the 10th of November, 3 days after the attempted robbery, Mullins found his way back to the bar. Sweggles went to Tyrrell immediately. Unfortunately, whilst everything had been happening in Springfield, Tyrrell's daughter-in-law had got the awkward news that she was pregnant with her father-in-law's baby. His wife was now seeking a divorce, and Tyrrell himself had been arrested on charges of adultery. Though he hadn't been held in prison long, everything had seemingly gone on top of him, and he was now sick in bed. While Sweggles waited for him to recover, he made his way back to the hub and, with some trepidation, met with Mullins and explained his own side of the story, telling him that he and Healy had seen the detectives and split, running off to Indiana, which was where Healy had stayed. Mullins bought the story, letting both Sweggles and Healy nicely off the hook for any suspicion. That night, Hughes returned to the hub. He wasn't alone, however, and had failed to realise that he'd been tailed all the way from the train station by Tyrrell, Washburn, Chicago police officer Denny Simmons, and the Pinkerton detective, McGinn. Tyrrell sent Simmons and McGinn into the saloon, figuring that they were the least recognisable. The two men ordered a beer whilst confirming the identities of the criminals. And then, McGinn pulled a gun on Mullen, while Simmons grabbed Hughes. Tyrrell and Washburn bounded in shortly after and made the arrests for both men, carting them off to the central police station. Once Mullen and Hughes had been arrested, Sweggles finally broke cover and gave the full story to the Chicago Tribune. Following the news of the arrests, people were beginning to come round to the idea that the whole story may actually well have been true. And by the time that Sweggles' side of events were printed on November the 18th, there were far fewer unbelievers, though the conspiracy still remained. The story occupied almost the entire front page and took up a good deal of page two also, and detailed much of the story from start to finish, including the motive to free Benjamin Boyd from prison. The following day, whilst Hughes and Mullen were being transported back to Springfield, a second piece hit the papers, which showed just how divided the public opinion was on the whole affair. Lincoln's remains, the men taken to Springfield. Although the whole plot to rob the grave of Abraham Lincoln at Springfield has been given publicity, and the details were certainly sufficient to carry conviction, a great many people still have doubts, and are not certain that the attempt was made. Not a few laugh at the statements published and say that the story is a newspaper hoax. Those who think this cannot force themselves to the belief that men are base and degraded enough to commit such a crime. To detectives who had nothing to do with the case, it has the appearance of a job put up by a private detective to get Elmer Washburn into a snap, it being understood that said detective was instrumental in having him removed from the position of Chief of the Secret Service. Others, again, claim it is a put-up job on general principles. This is the old cry. There never was a counterfeiter arrested yet, and never will be. But what his friends say, the Secret Service men have put up a job to catch him. The evidence collected against the class of criminals is so conclusive that there is absolutely no other defence. But fortunately, it is very rarely believed by a jury. It will be the defence in the case of Hughes and Mullins, arrested Friday night by Elmer Washburn and his assistants. Both of them, as we stated in yesterday's Tribune, are believed to be members of the Ben Boyd gang. Mr. W.W. O'Brien, their attorney, says, "A job has been put up to enable certain persons to make capital. and he promises some rich revelations at the preliminary examination or the trial. Mullins does not seem to regard the case, since he stated last evening that it was a piece of blackmail which had been going on for some time. As could be judged from their attitudes in the piece in the paper, back in jail, Mullins and Hughes had protested their innocence, both confirming that they had absolutely nothing to do with anything, and that they were not even sure why they'd been arrested at all. They must have felt some degree of dread when their attorney arrived, William O'Brien, and informed them that their good friend Jim Morrissey was really named Sweggles and had roped them in. Despite O'Brien's claims that he would have some rich revelations, the defence he was preparing was remarkably thin. During the preliminary hearing, bail was set at an unreachable $11,000, and the men were returned to await trial, which had been penciled in to take place the following week, but was quickly rescheduled after O'Brien claimed to have been suffering from an injury. Meanwhile, Tyrrell spent the days looking for evidence to tear down the gang member's flimsy alibi. Hughes and Mullen had said that they had caught a train to Gilman on the day of the robbery, so he visited the train station to view the sales records, of which there were none to Gilman on that particular day. The farmers from the farmhouse that Hughes and Mullen stopped by during their escape to ask for directions visited the jail in Springfield and positively identified both men from a lineup of 35 prisoners, as did the train conductor who had accepted Hughes's gun as security for their tickets. More dramatically, Tyrrell began to unravel the original plot for the Logan County gang to steal Lincoln's remains and discovered that both had been instigated by Keneally. Unfortunately, the ringleader had been wily enough so that he struggled to find any evidence tying him to either plan. But after all his hard work, it turned out that whilst he was combing the streets, the best evidence for the prosecution would be manufactured by Mullins himself, who spent his time in prison writing to various acquaintances and asking them to fabricate an alibi for him and Hughes. Naturally, any letters that the two men were writing were of course being monitored by the prison authorities, and so, rather than reaching their recipients, they were simply confiscated and entered into evidence instead. In one particularly damning section of a letter, written to a man named William Birdsall, Mullins wrote, "Birdsall, if you can't prove you took us towards Chestnut, get things fixed solid so that you can prove that we stayed with you all night. I think you can do it, if only you use your head a little. Hughes has long chin of whiskers, of a sandy colour, is not very fleshy, about 5 feet 8 inches. Mullins is about 5 feet 7 inches, long moustache and is rather fleshy. We will secure the money for you. I think we can raise $35 cash. The balance will give you good security. Give your brother an answer when you read this, and then we will get a private interview." Meanwhile, O'Brien was busy making his case that everyone involved on the detective side was of a shady character and not to be trusted. A bogus charge of stealing tools was set up for Sweggles, though it didn't get very far. Rather awkwardly for Tyrrell, however, was his ongoing situation with his daughter-in-law, which was just about the only glimmer of hope that the defence had at all. Eventually, the date of the trial was set for the 14th of March. But when that day rolled around, it was pushed back once more, and at the same time, scheduled to be moved to Logan County instead, this time on account of the judges being tied to the National Lincoln Monument Association. Finally, the trial did start, though the defence had found themselves without O'Brien, who had dropped the case at the last minute, which perhaps somewhat signalled the prisoner's bleak prognosis. One of the more complex aspects of the trial was simply swearing in the jury, which took a full day and a half and saw 77 men rejected in total for having too much knowledge of the case. Once things did finally get underway, the defence made their claim that the whole affair had been a grand conspiracy against Hughes and Mullins, set up by a group of detectives who were out to make a name for themselves. A line that may have held some track, at least until the third day, when the letters written whilst in jail by Mullins were read to the court, more or less cementing the outcome in one move. Both Hughes and Mullins were found guilty and sentenced to 1 year in prison, a month of which should be solitary confinement, and the remaining time spent on hard labour, along with a fine which would cover the fees of the prosecution. Following the conviction of Hughes and Mullins, there was still a surprising volume of discourse surrounding the whole case, as the public aired their views in the letters to the papers. Rumours of conspiracy still remained strongly alive, and matters were not helped when the Baltimore Sun printed a letter signed, somewhat strangely, by 10 of the 12 members of the convicting jury, stating that they believe Sweggles to have been the originator of the whole scheme. "To the people of Illinois, The undersigned, who constituted the jury which tried and convicted Hughes and Mullins on conspiracy to rob the tomb of Abraham Lincoln, believe it to be our duty to hereby state that we believe, from the evidence presented in the case, that L.C. Sweggles, who pretended to have discovered the conspiracy said to have been concocted by Hughes and Mullins, was himself the originator and instigator of the conspiracy, and used Hughes and Mullins as tools to carry out his own selfish ends. Despite this letter, nothing ever came of it, and the case remained closed. Tyrrell was awarded a large portrait of Abraham Lincoln for his efforts in the convictions. 2 years after the arrests, Power, the custodian of the Lincoln Monument, thought it was probably high time that he dealt with the remains of the dead president that still remained in the dank basement after being secretly stashed there following the robbery attempt. Power contacted the Monument Association but got little help, and so instead he worked on his own initiative to enlist the aid of 5 Springfield residents. The 6 men, including Power, branded themselves as an underground society known as the Lincoln Guard of Honor, with their first task to rebury the coffin in the north side of the basement under a strict pact of secrecy. One of the members drew up a diagram of the burial site and locked it away in his safe, and the whole messy event was put to bed, with nobody any the wiser that the sarcophagus above ground remained completely empty. In the years after, the same secret society reburied the body of Mary Lincoln next to her husband in the basement, again in strict secrecy in order to avoid any scandal, following her public funeral where she had been laid to rest in the tomb above. When Hughes and Mullins had served their sentences, Mullen left the prison a free man. Hughes was not so fortunate, and Tyrrell met him on the day before his release with a surprise indictment for pushing counterfeit $5 bills from 1875, which landed him a further 3 years in prison with hard labour. Meanwhile, Keneally had sold the hub and split for St. Louis, where he was finally arrested in 1880, following a tip-off from Mullins, who had once again been arrested for pushing counterfeit currency and done a deal with the Secret Service to turn informant against his old boss. In the same year, Sweggles, clearly having grown tired of the straight life, was arrested on suspicion of burglary. In 1887, the remains of Abraham Lincoln and his wife Mary were finally exhumed once more, and a permanent vault was built in the catacombs of the monument. In order to safeguard the remains from any further attempts to steal them, the coffin was entirely sealed on all sides by cement. The whole thing was a tough job to keep secret, however, and before long the details were leaked to the papers, though by then the dust had settled on the affair, and the truth of the remains caused little kickback from the public. The bodies remained in place until 1899, when structural issues with the monument made it a necessity for the new vault to be opened up and replaced once more. In 1901, the remains of Lincoln were moved to their final resting place in a freshly built tomb, 10 feet beneath the floor of the catacomb, where he remains until today. Fortunately, no one has ever tried to steal the remains since. And really, just like the Chicago Times asked way back in 1876, why would they? So that was the story of, well, Abraham Lincoln's remains being abducted, which, it's quite a funny one. There's a few bits to talk about, and we'll do so after these short advert breaks. Welcome back. Yeah, so kind of an interesting story, kind of a quirky bit of history. It's always a little bit intimidating. This one in particular, it's one of those sort of episodes that I find a little bit intimidating because the sort of the depth of American history, you know, talking about American presidents and things like that, it's a little bit scary when you know that the majority of your audience is Americans. But it's interesting for me to read up about. So I find these sort of episodes really interesting because for me it's like, I get to, you know, expand a little bit of my knowledge about, you know, American history, which isn't that great, to be honest. It's always fascinating. There is a really good book that I would recommend if you're interested in some further reading. It's called Counterfeiting in America, and it's written by someone called Lynn Glasser, G-L-A-S-E-R. Anyway, it's in the show notes under the sources. And I really enjoyed it because firstly, it's a good book anyway. It's an interesting book about the history of counterfeiting in America. But it's got loads of really great illustrations and photographs of, firstly, all the old dollar bills, like old fake counterfeit dollar bills. And secondly, all the plates that they used to make them. And they're incredible. The plates are really something else. Like, you imagine, you know, the counterfeits to be quite crude in a way, and in many respects they were, and we'll come to that in a second, but actually these plates are just incredibly intricate and just really well done. Some bills took like 3 or 4 different plates to print different sections on the bills and stuff, because they even printed like fake paper texture and stuff like that onto them. It was really quite impressive, and the plates are amazing, like amazingly intricate, and obviously it takes someone really skilled, which, you know, obviously this whole episode's about, because they needed Boyd because of his talent in engraving to make the notes. But also, what's also really funny about this book, and is probably worth reading just for the sake of just for this, is that some of the pictures of the bills are incredible, because whilst they went to all that effort to like fake these bills really well, some of them have just clear typos in some of the most prominent words on the bills, and they're awful. They're, you know, like some of the most prominent letters, even some of the denominations and stuff, are just spelt wrong. And it's unreal. Like, that, you know, you've got this bill that they spent all this time perfecting the plate, and then they just get these like obscene typos. It's really interesting. It's a beautiful book, and it's really interesting the way to read, but say all the illustrations and stuff are just really interesting, and say definitely worth having a look at that one if you're interested in some further reading. But anyway, all that's in the links, or the show notes rather, under the sources. But yeah, aside from that, there's not too much to talk about, I guess. The story itself I found really interesting, and obviously there were elements of it that I found especially interesting, like the Ropers, the Secret Service, that was really interesting, researching into those sorts of things. But aside from that, you know, there's not really any mystery. The case is pretty much done. One thing I do wish had happened was that the Logan County gang had not been arrested on the day before them planning to go to Springfield and carrying out the robbery, because it would have been just the most beautiful thing in the world if they'd have been trying to rob the tomb of Lincoln and the Hub gang had turned up to rob the tomb of Lincoln whilst they were robbing it. It would have been just even better than what did turn out, you know. And then you would have had the detectives running around with no shoes on, shooting bullets at each other whilst the two gangs were trying to rob each other of Lincoln's bones. It could have been some mad capture the flag episode on, you know, around Lincoln's like monument. It would have been glorious. But yeah, anyway, that didn't happen, so that was really sad. But otherwise, I it was a great story. I hope you enjoyed it. Thanks very much for your time today, and thanks very much for listening. If you'd like to contact me, the email is contact@darkhistories.com. There's obviously, that's in the show notes as well, as was all the other ways you can contact me via social media, things like that. There is also a website, darkhistories.com. Everything's on there, all the ways to contact me, and all the ways to support the podcast if you would like to do so. It doesn't have to be financial. It could be, you know, just 5 minutes to drop a review, or, you know, maybe, I don't know, talk about it on Reddit or something like that, because, you know, that does help me, because I'm a little bit useless. Or I say a little bit useless. I'd say I'm pretty much very useless at promoting the show. I get really self-conscious and sort of quite a lot of anxiety about posting, you know, promotional stuff for the podcast, because it's just not me, I guess. So any help that you can give me in that sense, you know, like sort of sharing it with your friends or writing reviews, that's great help. Anyway, enough of that. Thanks very much for listening. As always, it's been, you know, a pleasure, and thank you for, you know, giving your time to listen to the podcast. So thanks for that. I'll see you again in 2 weeks. So until then, take care, sleep tight.